how would this reconciliation enable Palestinians to see Al-Quds? Yet the timing of these two events, the Algiers reconciliation of Palestinian factions, then Hamas's trip to Syria, gives the impression that there are serious diplomatic moves being made between Palestinian factions. Another development, which is another piece to this puzzle, is the head of Hamas's political bureau chief, Ismail Haniyeh, visiting Moscow recently and holding high-level political talks with Russian officials, including the foreign minister Sergei Lavrov. This puts the spotlight on Russia's role here. Russia is signaling how it wants to play a more constructive role when it comes to the West Asia region, especially when it comes to Palestinians. This couldn't be any clearer than the stance that the PA President Mahmoud Abbas took when it came to Russia, which was relayed during the SICA meeting that was held recently. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who met with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, relayed to him his mistrust of the U.S. in resolving the conflict with Israel, expressing an appreciation for Russia's role. He voiced his support for the Mideast quartet of international mediators, namely Russia, the U.S., the United Nations, and the European Union, but said the U.S. could not be left a free hand to act alone. He said, "We don't trust America, and you know our position. We don't trust it, we don't rely on it, and under no circumstances can we accept that America is the sole party in resolving a problem." Maybe that is why the U.S. is raising the alarm over the reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas. Now that they are on one page, they can act with one voice against Israel and the U.S. And the U.S. reaction to this is very telling when it says that it will take this out against Palestinians, instead of taking a diplomatic approach towards the two groups reconciling, since they can speak with one voice for the Palestinians. This may mean that there will be more pressure and violations by Israel against the Palestinians with full U.S. support.
The Twitter account of UN Human Rights Council addressed the report published by the three-member commission and shared the link to it. The title of the report very clearly addresses the occupation to be unlawful under international law with zero ambiguity. The report states the reason for the conclusion to be the permanence of the occupation as well as Israel's de facto annexation policies. Navi Pillai, chair of the commission, stated, "Recent statements by the Secretary General and numerous member states have clearly indicated that any attempt at unilateral annexation of a state's territory by another is a violation of international law and is null and void. 143 member states, including Israel, last week voted in favor of a General Assembly resolution reaffirming this." The chair also further added, "Unless universally applied, including to the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, this core principle of the United Nations Charter will become meaningless." The 28-page report published by Navanethem Pillai, Milun Kothari, and Christopher Sidoti highlights the sustenance and the advancement of the settlement enterprise, and the continuous expansion over the past couple of years that resulted in many Palestinian families to be forced out of their homes only for foreigners who've never been to the land to occupy their homes.
Yaakov, you know this is not your house.
Yes, but if I go, you don't go back. So what's the problem? What are you yelling at me? I didn't do this.
But you're
easy to yell at me, but I didn't do this.
Yeah, you are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going
to
steal it.
No one is allowed to steal it, Yammi.
Statements by Israeli officials that showed their intention to maintain permanent control over the expanding settlements were also noted in the reports and were part of the reason why the occupation was declared unlawful. Chair of the commission also recognized the direct and indirect transferring of Israelis into the settlements as a plan to ensure permanent Israeli control in the West Bank. The Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including Al-Quds and in Israel. That is the name that the UN gave to the commission in May of 2021 when the UN Human Rights Council held a special session on the grave human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territory. During the session, the UNHRC decided to establish an urgent international commission of inquiry to investigate alleged human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories at the hands of Israel. The recent report is the culmination of what the three-member council has found during the past year and a half in what seems to be an uncharacteristically direct accusation of Israeli human rights violation and breaking of international law. Let's take a quick look at some of the bullet points mentioned in the report. An allusion to the core principles of the UN on annexation, which Israel seems to have also agreed to, even though it has violated it. The existence of a settlement enterprise and the efforts to make settlement permanent, violating the rights of Palestinians who were forced to leave as settlers took their homes by force. Israelis' exploitation of land and natural resources, the restrictive urban planning and zoning policies that seize Palestinian construction as an impediment to settlements that result in frequent confiscation of land, demolition of homes, and eventually displacement. The silent harm and psychological trauma resulting from erosion of economic, social, and cultural rights of Palestinians in a coercive environment that fragments the Palestinian society. The necessity of international action as Israeli government's actions are seen by the Commission as criminal, particularly its direct and indirect transfer of civilian population into occupied and annexed territories. The report seems to be a step in the right direction for the UN to fulfill its sole responsibility of standing up for human rights violations globally. But whether or not the criminal accusations towards Israel will lead to an International Court of Justice investigation and trial remains to be seen, especially when Israel has the unwavering support of the U.S.
Iran has doubled down on its earlier stance that it has not supplied weapons to Russia to be used against Ukraine. Foreign Ministry officials say those claims are untrue and based on false information. Tehran says the accusations are part of a propaganda campaign by the West to stoke tensions with Iran. The accusations against Iran have been leveled by Ukraine and its Western backers. They say Russia has been using Iranian-made drones to strike Ukrainian cities in recent weeks. The Kremlin has also roundly denied the accusation, saying it's using Russia-made weapons in its strikes. Also, some Western media outlets have cited U.S. security officials as saying that more Iranian drones as well as missiles are to be shipped to Russia. But the Pentagon says it cannot confirm those reports. However, it says it will take steps to make the sale of Iranian drones harder. Ukraine has also threatened to cut diplomatic ties with Iran. But Tehran says it holds a neutral stance and believes dialogue is the best way to end the war. Iran has invariably stressed the need for respect for various countries' sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, including Ukraine, based on the principles of the United Nations Charter.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has taken a clear and consistent position on the situation in Ukraine, which has been pronounced since the start of the conflict. The Islamic Republic of Iran has always emphasized that all UN members must fully respect the purpose and principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter as well as applicable international law.
The accusations against Iran come amid intensifying tensions at war fronts in Ukraine. Citizens and pro-Russian officials are evacuating from the main city in Kherson region just as Ukrainian forces are pushing to take back the area from Russia. Over 60,000 people will be evacuated within the next 6 days. The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July. Back then, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleged that Washington had received, quote, information indicating that Iran was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred unmanned aerial vehicles, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline. Flying at low altitude, these unmanned aircraft can evade traditional air defense systems before dive bombing their targets. The distinctive delta wing design of the drones has led Ukrainian and Western officials to claim that they are Iranian Shahed-136 UAVs. Russia's use of the so-called kamikaze drones has sparked panic in Ukraine. The United States, Britain and France were planning to raise the claim during a closed-door UN Security Council meeting. They accuse Iran of violating a UN Security Council resolution that had placed an arms embargo on Iran. The arms embargo expired in 2020, despite the efforts of former U.S. President Donald Trump to renew it.
Iran categorically rejected unfounded and unsubstantiated claims that Iran has transferred UAVs for the use of the conflict in Ukraine. It is recently disappointing that to pursue their political agenda, these states are trying to launch a disinformation campaign against Iran.
So, dear colleagues, today we have observed another round of the disinformation campaign from the Security Council by the Western delegations, as they raised in the Council the issue of the UAVs allegedly used by Russia in Ukraine. The aim of our Western colleagues is clear. They attempt to hit two targets at once, inventing an artificial pretext to put pressure on Russia and on Iran.
The accusations come amid continued NATO military support for Ukraine. The West is now under fire for fanning the flames of war by sending more and more military hardware there. It's now believed that the accusations made against Iran are part of a larger media campaign against the Islamic Republic. The West, led by the United States, were trying to pressurize Iran by supporting the rioters in Iran during the recent tensions. They imposed a series of sanctions on Iranian officials over human rights allegations. However, they failed to dictate their will on Iran.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از ایمان.
Self-purification is the most significant fact.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. Stay tuned.
متاسفانه ظاهرمون با باطنمون زبانمون
The words and actions of people are usually different. This means they say something and do something else. In other words, we are not what we display to others. As we read in Ayah 8 of Surah Al-Baqarah in the Holy Quran, among the people are those who say, "We have faith in Allah and the Last Day," but they have no faith.
اینا آنگونه که می نمایند نیستن. ببین این آب.
Such people, according to the Holy Quran, are not really what they show to others. On the other hand, we have a few people who are like water, crystal and clear. Conversely, some others are like mirage. They act as if they are like water, but in fact they are not. We must be like water, and our inner and outer look must be the same. This way, our deeds are accepted by Allah, and we establish sincerity among people. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRab English Radio Kalam Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Ranjbah. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Kalam Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The recent attacks by Zionist settlers against Palestinians are an attempt to inflame the situation in the occupied territories to the benefit of party campaigns ahead of the Zionist regime's next month's election. According to reports, these attacks have been perpetrated by a large number of settlers, including women and children. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Middle East Eye, there have been more than 100 attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank over the last 10 days, according to local media. The Israeli regime newspaper Haaretz recently said that most of the attacks it had documented had taken place in the northern West Bank, especially in the town of Hawara in Nablus Governorate. Last week, dozens of settlers attacked Palestinian property and vehicles in the Hawara area. Witnesses told Middle East Eye that masked settlers threw rocks at Palestinian vehicles near the town, as well as setting vehicles and olive trees on fire. Abdullah Odeh, who owns a local amusement park in Hawara, said residents had almost been successful in repelling the settlers when a group of Israeli troops arrived. The settlers were retreating, but when they saw the soldiers, they came back in force and started to get closer, breaking everything in their path, Odeh said, adding, "The soldiers did not push them back. Instead, they started to attack us and shoot towards us." Footage from Odeh's security cameras reviewed by Middle East Eye corroborates his history. He says, "While the soldiers were pushing us back and attacking us, the settlers started to set fire to one of our vans that was parked higher up on the hill, while another group of them came and started to set fire to one of our lorries. Armed with stones, sticks and guns, another group of settlers began throwing rocks at passing cars and smashing up shops along the town's main road. Recently, two activists were injured by Zionist settlers armed with stones and clubs while helping Palestinians harvest olives in the village of Kesan, south of Beit Lahm. Tali Katzir, an activist who was at the scene, told Haaretz, "About 20 settlers arrived and started attacking the harvest volunteers." Katzir said Hagar Gefan, a 70-year-old human rights activist, was among those injured. Katzir said she suffers from broken ribs and bruises all over her body. Knesset lawmakers Aida Tuma Silman and Ofer Kassit from Hadas Tatal condemned the attack and called for those behind it to be held responsible. "This horrific attack is a direct result of the criminal silence from Prime Minister Yair Lapid, Benny Gantz, and Public Security Minister Omer Bar-Lev in the face of settler terrorism," Tuma Suleiman said. Haaretz said that while Israeli Chief of Staff Aviv Kochavi had been quick to condemn attacks by settlers on Israeli soldiers, no such criticism had been made by the army over attacks against Palestinians. An Israeli troop from an illegal West Bank settlement near Nablus was arrested on suspicion of participating in a settler attack on an Israeli regime unit earlier in the day. Recently, a group of settlers threw rocks at passing Palestinian vehicles in Hawara before attacking Zionist regime troops dispatched to the area with pepper gas. A security source told the newspaper that contrary to claims by senior security officials that attacks on Palestinians were being carried out by an out-of-control handful of settlers, well known to the security establishment, they were in fact being perpetrated by a large number of settlers, including women and children. The source added that attacks by settlers were an attempt to inflame the situation in the occupied territories to the benefit of party campaigns ahead of the Zionist regime's next month's election. Palestinian Wafa News Agency also reported the daily Israeli newspaper Haaretz revealed that more than 100 attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians have been documented in different areas of the West Bank in the last 10 days. The newspaper stated that in the last 10 days, settlers have attacked Palestinians more than 100 times, and that most of these attacks took place in northern West Bank, especially in the town of Hobara in Nablus. It said that these settlers' violence was not addressed by the Zionist regime's army, who was quick to condemn the settlers' pepper spray attack against the troops. The newspaper denied claims by the Zionist regime army that those who carry out attacks against Palestinians are a minority, stating that this is not true because there are large numbers of settlers who take part in the attacks against Palestinians. In this regard, Wafa correspondents reported that the Zionist regime occupation army did not arrest or investigate settlers who attack on a daily basis the Palestinian citizens and their property, but rather guards the aggressor, the settler, and provides them with protection.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Keeping Secrets. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of keeping secrets in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic teachings, we see that Islam emphasizes on the personality or the respect of each other. Therefore, it also talks about the keeping the secrets of each other. Now, we should know that when we talk about the secrets, which is known as asrar or sir or raz, like in different languages they use these words, this is known as something which is need to be kept secret from a group of people, maybe, or some special people or specific people should know about it, or maybe no one should know about it, and it's something which is related to someone's personal life. Therefore, these secrets can be related to the social aspect or the social life of a person, or it can be related to the personal life of the person. Therefore, it is necessary in Islam that we must keep the secrets of the people if we know about the secrets. Why? Because if we disclose the secrets, it might damage the personality of a person. It might bring a danger to his life. Or maybe sometimes he can even lose his life in the disclosure of the secrets. Therefore, for the mu'mineen, for the believers, it is necessary to keep each other's secrets if they get to know. Or maybe if someone is sharing his secrets with someone as someone who he can trust, then obviously we should not break his trust. We should keep the trust of the person. And this is one of the characteristics of the believers, that he is trustworthy, he is truthful, he keeps the secrets of the others, and obviously he is someone who can be trusted in all times, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of keeping secrets in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that every person has some secrets in their individual life as well as in their social life. Therefore, it is necessary that if someone knows about that, he should keep those secrets with him and should not disclose. We know that everyone has it, and there is no one, no exception amongst the people. And there are some things which they never wanted anyone to know about it. And therefore, this is known as something which is personal or related to himself. And on the same basis, spying someone is being forbidden in Islam. We cannot spy on the others. But in the case of preventing the country from the enemies, that is the only case where it has been allowed. Otherwise, in Islam, even spying on others and looking into others' life, being after the secrets of the others, all these things are forbidden in the Islam, and Islam says not to perform such things. And therefore, we even see that even Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam has said, "Afsha'u sirri suqutun," that when someone discloses someone's secrets, then obviously it is just like falling down from a hill. So if someone discloses the secrets of the others, then Allah also never kept their secrets. We have many things which only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows about us. Therefore, if we disclose the secrets of the others, and if it results the dishonor or humiliation of the person, then Allah never keeps our respect amongst the people. Therefore, we must be careful in these situations, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
British Prime Minister Liz Truss finally resigned, as experts had predicted her collapse days and even weeks before. Liz Truss's legacy for Britain was a tanking pound, soaring inflation, and a seemingly inevitable recession. World media websites have analyzed this issue and the economic challenges that face Britain. Stay tuned for the third part, please. Guardian wrote, Liz Truss ignored the stark warnings from economists sympathetic to her growth strategy that the mini-budget that ultimately led to her downfall risked triggering a financial market's meltdown. The Guardian has learned. Truss announced her resignation recently after just 44 days in Downing Street after a package of tax cuts and spending increases on September 23rd rattled the markets, prompted a run on pension funds, and sent the cost of mortgages spiraling. But days before the start of her premiership, she was told by The Economist, Gerard Lyons and Julian Jessop, that the markets were highly nervous and that she could face a crash if her policy changes were not handled with care. Lyons and Jessop, who were supportive of Truss' growth agenda, prepared a paper for a meeting at Chevening, the country residence of Foreign Secretary S. Truss was 2 days before she was announced as Boris Johnson's successor on September 5th. Also in attendance were Kwasi Kwarteng, who would be Truss's chancellor, Matteo Sinclair, Truss's economic policy advisor, and a third economist, Andrew Lilico. The paper supported the idea that the new government needed to hit the ground running, but repeatedly stressed the need to keep the financial markets one side. Predicting the chaos that was to follow Kwarteng's £45 billion of unfunded tax cuts announced in his September 23rd mini-budget, it said, the markets are nervous about the UK and about the policy options. If immediate economic policy announcements are handled badly, then a market crash is possible. It suggested the best policy option for the UK was to have higher interest rates from the Bank of England to curb inflation and tax cuts, and spending increases from the Treasury to mitigate recession risks. However, financial markets are concerned that any fiscal easing may add to inflation, the paper added. Thus, to keep the markets one side, it is important that fiscal policy is explained clearly, that fiscal actions now are targeted and further ahead are focused on the supply side of the economy. There is a need to convince the markets that fiscal action is necessary, affordable, and non-inflationary. The hostile market reaction to the mini-budget led to most of the tax changes being reversed before Truss announced she was quitting. Kwarteng's successor, Jeremy Hunt, is expected to announce the spending cuts in a fiscal statement that is still scheduled to be held on September. Although that may change now, there is another conservative leadership race. Jessop said recently, "We were pretty clear the markets were very fragile and nervous. We said they needed to tread carefully and stage the process. We said there was a significant risk of a market crisis. And that's what happened. The overall strategy was right. The handling of it was terrible." Jessop said the opportunity to deliver on the growth strategy had now been lost. Supply side reforms need a strong, committed prime minister. We have gone back to what we were trying to avoid. A doom loop of tax increases, spending cuts, and weak economic growth. A deep recession now starts to look more likely. Neither Lyons nor Jessop discussed the mini-budget with Truss after she became prime minister. Although Lyons again warned Kwarteng of the need to beware the markets in the days leading up to the fiscal event. "I sent a further note to the Chancellor after reading in the Sunday Times that the cuts in the stamp duty would feature as part of a mini-budget. The papers were making it out to be a much bigger event than the markets had expected it to be," Lyons said. He said the markets responded badly to the Kwarteng's initial package, but what tipped them over the edge was his announcement 2 days later that there would be more tax cuts to come. The markets were febrile, and that should have reinforced the need to be more careful. In their paper, Lyons and Jessop pointed to 5 policy challenges facing the new administration: addressing the energy crisis, inflation and the cost of living crisis, economic slowdown, departmental spending, particularly in areas of health, as higher inflation will have reduced the real spending power of planned government spending, and the need to avoid an imminent financial crisis and a sterling crash by outlining policies to address the above. They added, fiscal responsibility is paramount. Through a commitment to reducing the ratio of debt to GDP over time, thus ensuring solvency. Over time, public spending needs to be kept under control, with tax rates low. The fact that expectations about future economic and regulatory policy are low creates a great opportunity, but only if the new government hits the ground running. The only way to confront the present situation is to act decisively and not to hesitate, thus sending a clear message to the public and the financial markets.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. The prophets are all drivers of a single caravan, guiding the caravan on a single path, leading it to a single destination, with people from all places all going together towards a single terminus. The faithful say, "We make no distinction between any of his apostles." The Quran, Surah 2, verse 285. We respect Isa, Musa, Ibrahim, and Idris just as much as Ya'qub. We respect Jesus, Moses, Abraham, and Idris just as much as Jacob and George, just as much as Noah. We respect all of the prophets, from the first to the last. All of them were acting by God's command. All of them were directed by Him to the same destination. All of them gave glad tidings of the same felicity and the same paradise. All of them followed the same line. We make no distinction between any of His apostles. As for why we believe in the prophethood of this line of prophets, we will, inshallah, discuss this in turn on another occasion. And they say, this is a part of Surah number 2, verse 285. Pay attention to these two or three sentences as they illustrate something that we will return to later.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
So the prophets have faith. Our prophet has it. The believers and those that follow him also all have faith. And they say, we hear and obey. In other words, they hear, they understand, and they obey. Hearing here does not simply signify sounds reaching their ears. Hearing is more than this. Hearing is more than this. Because the act of hearing involves more than just one's ear. You might tell someone to lend an ear when you are speaking to them, but at the end, what do you ask them? You ask, did you hear what I said? Now, obviously, when you are talking to someone, there is no more than half a meter separating you. Your normal speaking voice can carry for 10 meters or more. So, of course, he heard what you said, but what you really mean is, did he understand it? Of course, it went into his ear, but what you want to know is, did it go into his mind? So, when those with faith say, we hear, this means we understand with the totality of our being what Allah sent down to us and what He specified for us, and obey. What does this mean then? It does not mean blind obedience. It means that they obey based on knowledge and understanding of what they have heard.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The 18th General Assembly of the Organization of Asia-Pacific News Agencies gathered up members of the media entity in Tehran to discuss new trends in news production and explore areas of cooperation between its members.
So basically, OANA has now become somewhat of a center of the world-balanced approach to journalism. Nowadays, it's quite difficult to find media companies outside of Asia and Africa who are looking for a balanced approach to news. Basically, a lot of the major media companies of the world have decided to play only for one side.
I'm from Lebanon's state news agency. I believe this summit provides a platform for media diplomacy between the member news agencies to reach common grounds on world affairs.
OANA currently has 43 members from 35 countries, covering two-thirds of the world population. As a member, the Islamic Republic News Agency, or shortly IRNA, is hosting this year's General Assembly, based on a voting that took place during the 17th OANA Summit in Seoul, South Korea.
Today is a good opportunity for the representatives of prominent news agencies present in Tehran for the OANA meeting to observe the conditions in Iran. An independent media current is needed to disseminate the realities.
Formed in 1961 on UNESCO's initiative, the Organization of Asia-Pacific News Agencies is an association of news agencies from UNESCO member states in the Asia-Pacific region. OANA provides a newswire service containing articles provided by its members. Aside from IRNA, Iran's Fars News and Mehr News agencies are also among OANA members.
Delegates here say OANA's main goal is to break the Western monopoly on media and to present an alternative narrative on regional and global developments, as opposed to, quote, the narrative offered by mainstream media. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Russian flag now flies over Donetsk, as Russia claims this region is now part of the Russian Federation. The streets in the center are quiet as Ukraine continues to bomb the city. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. In order to find out how people here feel about their new identity, I headed down the road to the adjoining city of Makiivka. There are more people on the streets as it's safer here.
We are very happy. We've been waiting for it for a long time. We're very glad. All acquaintances, neighbors, all people surrounding me are grateful to Russia.
It's a complicated question. After everything that's been going on, it can be no other way now. There is no other way but to be with Russia. We were close people always. We couldn't be divided. We lived quite okay in Ukraine, but it's no longer Ukraine. Their authorities are not Ukrainian anymore.
This is a common sentiment in Donbass, that they were happy being part of Ukraine. But when the nationalists came to power in 2014 and began discriminating against Russian culture and bombing civilians here, they turned toward Russia.
We have been waiting for it. Donbass was eager to become part of Russia. We have the same values, culture, and now that we are part of Russia, we can be ourselves.
I'll tell the truth. While they've been shelling us and we were living in fear, in Kiev, they were enjoying themselves. Nobody in Kiev paid any attention. There are people there who support and understand us, but they cannot speak about it. They can be killed or imprisoned by the SBU for this. We're not against Ukrainian civilians. We are Ukrainian people too. I have relatives there. We have pity for people in Kiev, but nobody's killing them there on purpose.
Thousands have been killed by Ukrainian shelling over the last 8 years here. Hardly a day goes by without more civilians dying. Most of the anger I hear, though, is directed at the Ukrainian government, not its people.
I sympathize with them very much. I am always against people being killed, but it's war. Nothing can be done about it. They're killing us and we have to defend ourselves. Sometimes we had to hide in basements because of shelling. I work at school. Our school was under shelling. The windows were smashed. It's very scary.
Now, doing vox pops in cities on issues around the world, you usually get a variety of opinions. Not so here. Everybody I've spoken to says they want to join Russia. The only difference of opinion seems to be just how much sympathy they have for people in Kiev now living under shelling themselves. The people here have been doing so for the last 8 years. While the southern regions of Zaporozhye and Kherson are more mixed, for peace to come, it's clear the world needs to accept that the vast majority of people in Donbass no longer want to be part of Ukraine. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
It's taken him a few weeks longer than anticipated, but former Chancellor Rishi Sunak is now the leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister-elect of the UK, and of course, the first ethnic minority to hold either position. In a rather stage-managed affair, Sunak made his first public address to the nation.
But there is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity, and I will make it my utmost priority to bring our party and our country together.
Sunak had been the favoured candidate with fellow MPs in the leadership contest held in the summer, but had to settle for runner-up spot. This after Liz Truss won the vote of the Tory party members. This time, MPs saw to it that this was an internal matter, with voters looking on as yet another Conservative MP was anointed.
We had Johnston, we had Liz Truss very briefly, and now we have Sunak. Ordinary people in Britain have got no say over who becomes Prime Minister. That is a democratic deficit, and I think it sticks in the throats of many, many people in this country.
Sunak was keen to emphasise unity and stability, but those might be wishful ideas for a party that's literally at war with itself.
But there's been so much infighting within inside the Conservative Party, it's very difficult to see how they can all just lay down their knives and be friends again. Now, obviously, the sight of Labour running well ahead in the opinion polls will unite them. They're not lemmings. They don't want to commit suicide. That's why there won't be an election soon.
Prime Minister.
Sunak's leadership will be tested by the presence of figures like former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who claimed to have had the support to run for high office, but conceded now was not the right time for his return. How can Sunak ensure he doesn't follow the Liz Truss path to political collapse?
For many, the British premiership is a poison chalice. With the country facing one of the worst cost of living crises in a generation, with, of course, more austerity measures bound to be implemented and a political landscape more divided than ever, the new occupants of Downing Street face a Herculean task to try and pull Britain back from the brink.
Amina Taylor, London.
EU leaders at a summit in Brussels agreed China is becoming too assertive. It's the same phrase they have been using for years with respect to Russia. Iran was also in their sights. New restrictive measures against Tehran were rubber-stamped.
Sanctions have been taken against those who are participating in the repression of peaceful demonstrations, and this, of course, is linked to the support of Russia against Ukraine.
Analysts say the allegations against Iran are spurious and they are being vehemently contested. It's pointed out that the bloc sometimes ignores clear international law violations, even when there's zero ambiguity, for example, those perpetrated by Israel against Palestinians. The US is set to have even greater influence over the EU as the bloc moves to try and isolate Moscow and Beijing. It's suggested that has been Washington's plan all along.
Europe, they are totally dependent on the United States and in energy field and in military field. And that is dependency that doesn't allow them to conduct independent foreign policies.
Sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have driven energy costs to unmanageable levels. A complex package has been agreed in principle by EU leaders to try and lower prices and demand.
There's a lot of work now ahead of us what the energy is concerned, but the roadmap is very clear. And it was good to have this unanimity, this broad support for the roadmap that we have put forward.
Leaders admit the energy package is very complex and will take up to 3 weeks to try and finalise. Will this summit deliver positive results for EU citizens? It's a crucial question for millions of households and businesses, but also a vital political question for the bloc's leaders. Extreme left and extreme right anti-EU parties are waiting in the wings. Ignoring massive corruption findings by their own financial watchdog, EU leaders have agreed to provide €18 billion to the Ukrainian government in 2023. But that's nothing compared to what they will spend on lethal weapons for the country's army. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
It's no land at the heart of a scorching but amazing island. Nowtown is one of the latest entertainment centers in Iran's Kish Island in the Persian Gulf. Every year, some 2 million visitors from inside and outside Iran visit the island to enjoy its attractions, from its entertainment centers to its stunning beach.
The beach and the pier in Kish are really peaceful and tranquilizing. It's the third time I'm visiting the island, and I went parasailing, water skiing, and I'm planning to go scuba diving.
Kish Island offers all kinds of sea entertainment activities, from scuba diving to sailing, and oh yes, flyboarding. Besides sea sports, visitors can enjoy its amusement parks and a range of leisure activities inside the island. And if you're a tireless window shopper, Kish is a land of malls and shopping centers.
Kish is an amazing island. It used to be an abandoned island some 3 decades ago, but today it is a luxurious tourist resort with modern buildings and exciting recreational places.
Despite all the pleasure one can have in Kish, the island still has many shortcomings. The major issue annoying visitors is the poor accommodation services.
Hotel facilities and services are a bit weak given the large number of tourists that visit this island. They need to pay more attention to the accommodation infrastructure.
Just a few hundred kilometers away from Kish, there's a tourist magnet in the United Arab Emirates, Dubai,
which absorbs the chunk of foreign tourists, while U.S. sanctions on Iran are a major factor to blame for Kish lagging behind in its rivalry with Dubai. The island's officials believe it still has a chance to win the game of tourism against Dubai.
If we want to excel, it is not going to be a tough job. We need to work on two major areas. The first is the infrastructure, and the second is regulations that would allow tourists or investors to easily come to Kish to entertain themselves or do business.
Situated off the southern coast of Iran in the Persian Gulf, Kish is one of Iran's free trade zones. Foreign travelers do not need a visa to visit the island, as